Let's turn to Mark chapter 12. Mark chapter 12. We're going to be looking at the parable of the defiant tenants in Mark chapter 12, verses 1 through 12. And this is connected with the previous context. In fact, Mark 11:27 through 12:27 is all connected, and it's an important part of the narrative here because it establishes the fact that the hostility towards Jesus did not just come from one group of the Jews. It came from all of them. All the leaders of nation Israel were against him. We had the hostility of the chief priests, the scribes, and the elders in 11:27, where it said they came again to Jerusalem, and as he was walking in the temple, the chief priests and the scribes and the elders came to him and began saying to him, "By what authority are you doing these things?" So they are questioning his authority, and that authority will be continued to be questioned. He will answer it this hour in a parable, and that's the parable of the vine growers or the tenants. And then we had the defiant tenants, and they kill the owner's son, as we'll see this evening. And that parable concludes by telling us that the parable was directed against this same group. In verse 12 of chapter 12, it says, "And they were seeking to seize him, and yet they feared the people, for they understood that he spoke the parable against them." So that parable ties back in with 11:27, the chief priests, the scribes, and the elders. Now in verse 13 of chapter 12, we'll have the Herodians joining in to this group that is opposed to Jesus. And in verse 13, it says, "Then they sent some of the Pharisees and Herodians out to him in order to trap him in a statement." Now, we mentioned before, the Pharisees and the Herodians normally didn't get along all that well, but they had a common enemy, and they were against Jesus. And then in 12:18, we have the Sadducees. They're the ones who controlled, actually, the Sanhedrin. In 12:18, it says, "Some Sadducees, who say there's no resurrection, came to Jesus and began questioning him, saying, 'Teacher, Moses wrote for us that if a man's brother dies and leaves behind a wife and leaves no child, his brother should marry the wife and raise up the children to his brother.'" And then they go into this story about the seven brothers and say, when the wife gets to heaven, if she's resurrected, you know, whose husband will she be? So they're still trying to trap him. They're using the same methodology that they have been using all along. They plan to trap Jesus in his teaching. They want to get him to say something they can use against him. And first they question his authority. We looked at that in 11:28. And then he responds to them. First of all, he responds to them by establishing the authority of John the Baptist. And at the end of chapter 11, in verse 33, answering Jesus, Jesus had asked them, was the baptism of John the Baptist, was it from heaven or from man? And he kind of caught them in a trap or a trick question, because if they said it was from heaven, they would have to admit that they rejected John the Baptist and therefore had rejected the heavenly one. And they would have to accept the authority of Jesus as well. But if they said no, the crowds would have taken them away probably and strung them up, because they were very much in favor of John the Baptist, the masses. So they finally just said, "I don't know." And Jesus said to them in the last part of verse 33, "Nor will I tell you by what authority I do these things." He said, "You don't want information. You're trying to trick me. So I'm not going to tell you. What I'll do is I'll give you a parable." And they will understand the parable, as we saw in verse 12. They understand very clearly who he's talking about in the parable of the defiant tenants. Then they go on to question him about taxes in 12, 13, and 14. And these are the Pharisees and Herodians, remember. In verse 14, it says they came to him, "Teacher, we know that you are truthful and defer to no one, for you are not partial to any, but teach the way of God in truth. Is it lawful to pay a poll tax to Caesar or not?" So they're trying to trap him again. Because if he says yes, then they'll say, well, that's a man that you're paying homage to. And if he says no, then they can go to the Romans and say, look, this guy refuses to pay his taxes, and the Romans would have taken care of him. So that, again, they're trying to trick him. And the same thing about remarriage, the one we just looked at from the Sadducees who did not believe in resurrection. So now let's look at the parable, of the defiant tenants in 12, 1 through 12. And remember, this is still connected with the context of his authority. They were asking him, where do you get the authority to say these things? Chapter 12, verse 1 says, "And he began to speak to them in parables. A man planted a vineyard and put a wall around it and dug a vat under the wine press and built a tower and rented it out to vine growers and went on a journey. At the harvest time, he sent a slave to the vine growers in order to receive some of the produce of the vineyard from the vine growers. They took him and beat him and sent him away empty-handed. Again, he sent them another slave, and they wounded him in the head and treated him shamefully. And he sent another, and that one they killed, and so with many others, beating some and killing others. He had no one more to send, a beloved son. He sent him last of all to them, saying, 'They will respect my son.' But those vine growers said to one another, 'This is the heir. Come, let us kill him, and the inheritance will be ours.' And they took him and killed him and threw him out of the vineyard. And what will the owner of the vineyard do? He will come and destroy the vine growers and will give the vineyard to others. Have you not even read this scripture? 'The stone which the builders rejected, this became the chief cornerstone. This came about from the Lord, and it is marvelous in our eyes.' And they were seeking to seize him, and yet they feared the people, for they understood that he spoke the parable against them. And so they left him and went away." So as it ends up, they get cold feet and leave because the people would have torn them to pieces had they gone through with their plan. Now remember, we're still talking about Jesus' authority here, and this parable is included in all three of the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. It's central to the conversation that's going on here because it answers the question of Jesus' authority. And verse 28, we just read in 11:28, "By what authority are you doing these things? Who gave you the authority to do these things?" And then in verse 3, we noticed when they asked him directly, he did not respond directly. Verse 33 of chapter 11, he said, answering Jesus, they said, "We do not know," talking about the baptism of John. "And Jesus said to them, 'Nor will I tell you by what authority I do these things.'" So he didn't give them a straight answer when they asked him. What he will do now is give a parable. And this parable reflects the social conditions of the time. And as you know, the method we use in studying the Bible here at Bethaven is called the grammatical historical method. In other words, I look at the grammar of the text, I look at the syntax, the language, the translation, and the history that's behind it. because they had some historical things going on at the time that we probably couldn't relate to. Galilee, for example, was full of landed estates. They had these huge, beautiful estates in Galilee, and the estate owners lived elsewhere, and they hired people to come and take care of the land for them. So there's going to be tension when you have a situation like that. You know, the people that take care of the land are going to say, hey, I deserve this. It should be mine. I'm the one that takes care of it. He just owns it. You know, and workers of the world unite type thing. And pretty soon they'd have a revolution. So there were always land-hungry tenant farmers. There were always these landowners. And there was tension between them. In fact, the text points out that we just read it, that they killed the people he sent to collect his portion of the revenues. And according to Lane, in his commentary, he says that some of the papyri, you know, the papyri are non-biblical Greek papers, and it shows that situations like the one described here actually happened. People actually did this. Now, why did they kill the son? First, let's look at the classification of the parables. It's one of those parables that fall into the class called judgment parables. And what that means is simply this. A judgment parable is a dramatic presentation of a life situation. They would be very familiar with this situation, and it invites judgment on the ones hearing it. So he says, you guys are going to be judged, because what would the vineyard owner do? He said he'd come back and he would judge the tenants and give the land to somebody else. So it invites judgment to those who are listening. This parable does two things, in fact. It exposed the attempt against Jesus' life, first. And secondly, it revealed God's judgment against the people who planned to take his life. So it falls very easily into that classification called the judgment parables. Now the story is in verse 1 through 8. We just read that, so I won't read it again. But first question we have to answer is in 12:1, where it says, and he began to speak to them in parables. Who's the them he's talking about here? That's why it's dangerous to study things out of context. Who's the them? Them is a pronoun. Pronouns have what's called an antecedent or a reference. They have to be talking about somebody, unless you just say, they said, and we all laugh at that, you know, who is they? Well, who's the them here he began to speak to? So what's the reference to that pronoun? Well, you have to look at the context. And it's very easy to determine in the context, because in 11:27, we just read it. Who were the ones that were questioning his authority? It was the chief priests, the scribes, and the elders. So they're the ones he's talking to. So the parable is addressed to not the masses, not the disciples, but the representatives of the Jewish high court. And the Jewish high court ruled the Jews. Even the Romans gave them a lot of latitude that they didn't give to other city-states or provinces. They gave them a lot of latitude, but they did not allow them to carry out a capital punishment. They had to have permission from Rome to do that. But these guys were the group, the Sanhedrin, that controlled the Jews. And that's who Jesus is talking to. Look up at verse 12 of chapter 12, where it says, they were seeking to seize him, and yet they feared the people, for they understood he spoke the parable against them. And it's the same them of chapter 1 that goes clear back to 11:27, the chief priests, the scribes, and the elders. So he's talking to the leaders of the Jewish nation. Now, it's possible, and some say that these leaders were ready to leave after he refused to give them a direct answer when they asked where he got his authority. But he came after them and, you know, approached them and said, look, I want to tell you a story. So if that's true, Jesus is being aggressive here. And Jesus is revealing his person here. And we'll look at that in just a moment. Because remember, he didn't always do that. He used to keep out of the big cities. He used to keep a low profile. But then when he entered Jerusalem in what's called the triumphal entry, he let the cat out of the bag, so to speak. He let the people mount him on the horse, the colt. He let them put palm trees down in his path, and he kind of let things out of the bag. And now he's going to do it a little further, because he's going to come out and tell these guys exactly where his power comes from. Now, when we look at this parable, it has several elements that are very interesting. First, the number of messengers. In verse 2 and 3, remember, the landowner sent the first slave out. In verse 2, it said, at harvest time, he sent a slave to the vine growers in order to receive some of the produce of the vineyard from the wine growers. And that's how sharecropping works, you know. The people that are the tenants get some, and the owner gets some. In verse 3, they took him and beat him and sent him away empty-handed. So they wouldn't give him, that is the slave, what he was entitled to bring back to his master. So what does his master do? He sends a second slave in verse 4. Again, he sent them another slave, and they wounded him in the head. And they treated him shamefully. Then he sends a third slave. Now notice all of these representatives he's sending. And who's that talking about in the parable? The prophets, the ones he sent before Jesus. What happened to the prophets? They were killed. Read Hebrews chapter 11 if you want to find out about what happened to the prophets. They were treated horribly, just like the tenants are treating the landowner's slaves. So he sent the third slave. The third slave, they killed him. So he sent many others. So there's a whole bunch of people that preceded the son. Finally, in verse 6, he sends his own son. And this is going to be very clear to these leaders of the Sanhedrin that he's talking about himself. Another interesting thing, the varied forms of mistreatment. They just treated this guy's slaves like they were dirt. I mean, the first one was beaten. The second one, they conked on the head. The third, they killed him. The son was not only killed, but they threw him over the wall of the vineyard without a burial or anything, just kind of tossed him aside. So that's adding insult to injury. These tenants were bad people. There's just no getting around that. These were bad guys. Another interesting thing, the vineyard owner. I mean, what he does here is unheard of. After the beating of the first slave, what does he do? He sends another one. And then after the other one is wounded, what does he do? He sends a third slave. Rather than just sending a group of soldiers down there and taking away the vineyard and killing all of the tenants, he sends another slave. And even after they killed the third slave, he sends many others. So he's done everything possible in his power to try and get fruit from these guys, and they refuse. They're stubborn. After all of this mistreatment, he sends his own son. Another interesting thing about this parable is the absolute, utter defiance of the tenants. In verse 7 and 8, it says, "But those vine growers said to one another, 'This is the heir. Come, let us kill him, and the inheritance will be ours.' They took him and killed him and threw him out of the vineyard over the wall." He said he put a wall around the vineyard, remember, in verse 1. They threw him over the wall, didn't give him a burial or anything. They just left him there. So the tenants are defiant to the max. They're rebellious to the max. Now I have to cross a little culture bridge as I talked about the history behind this. They apparently had assumed that since the son came instead of the landowner himself, they apparently assumed that the landowner had died because they called the son the heir. And they figured that the sole heir to the vineyard was coming to collect his inheritance. Now, the interesting part is that under specific circumstances in their law, an inheritance could be regarded as ownerless property. And then it could be legally claimed by anyone. Well, guess what one of those circumstances was? Well, if the inheritance wasn't claimed within a specified period of time, that became public land. Anybody could stake a claim on it, as we would say. And that's what they're figuring. They said, well, look, the landowner must have died. He sent his son, who's the only heir. Let's kill him. And then when he doesn't show up to collect the inheritance, we can get it because we live here. So they could have claimed it because they had possession. So that was their reasoning. Now the question, in verse 9 through 11, verse 9 says, what would the owner of the vineyard do? Pretty simple question for these guys. Here are these tenants who are absolutely rebellious. They're absolutely bad. What would the owner of the vineyard do after they killed his son? Well, he would come and destroy the vine growers and will give the vineyard to others. So now, derived from the parable, we can see that there's going to be a judgment. It says right in the parable, in verse 9, he will come and destroy the vine growers, the tenants. And yet, there will be hope, because he doesn't say that he'll destroy the land. He says he'll give it to someone else, or he will give the vineyard to others. Now, if you look back at Psalms, in Psalm 118, flip back to Psalm 118 for a second. In verse 22 and 23, we see where Jesus is quoting from when he quoted about the stone that the builders rejected being the chief cornerstone. In verse 22, it says, "The stone which the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone. This is the Lord's doing. It is marvelous in our eyes." So it's explained by the Psalms, and again, rejection and a reversal. And that's back up in our Mark passage, verse 10 of chapter 12. "The stone which the builders rejected," there's a rejection, "this became the chief cornerstone." So there is a reversal of that judgment. Man rejected the Son. God reversed man's judgment. It's what this parable is saying. And this citation that he makes here, he's citing from the Psalms, he does it to limit the application of the parable to Jesus and the people who are listening to him. So he says, this is talking about me and it's talking about you. And it confirms the identification of Jesus with the Son. So what he's doing is contrasting his status before men. What did men think of him? All of the leaders of the nation Israel, what did they think of him? They rejected him. They despised him. They were disgusted with him. And then on the other hand, God has appointed glory to him. So that you see the contrast there. God is going to reverse the judgment of man with a startling display of his power. And he's going to turn this defeat into a victory. And remember, we said when we were studying some of the other Gospels, I forget which one, Luke maybe, that when Christ died on the cross, Satan was probably having a party with all his demons, thinking, I won! I got him, finally! And then Jesus rose again and said, wait a minute, you know, the very thing that you did to try and get rid of me has just saved all of mankind, or all of the believers. So Satan was probably very disappointed when he found that out. He's not omniscient, you know. He didn't know. Look at Acts chapter 4. In verse 11, it says, he is the stone which was rejected by you, the builders, but which became the chief cornerstone. And there is salvation in no one else. So the one that they threw out in the parable, they threw him out of the vineyard. He was rejected by man. He became the chief cornerstone, and there's no other way to salvation except by him. So Satan played right into God's hands when he planned to have Jesus killed. He turned that defeat into an incredible victory. Look at 1 Peter 2. And verse 7. This precious value then is for you who believe. But for those who disbelieve, the stone which the builders rejected, this became the very cornerstone. So you see this quotation quite often in the New Testament because it's talking about God's reversal of man's judgment. Man judged the son of the vineyard owner in the parable, or Jesus Christ, man judged him to be insufficient. You know, you can't do. What authority do you have? You can't do what you say. I can get to heaven on my own. Man is still rejecting him. Man still says the same thing. How could he do that? That's not fair. I work hard. Just like the elders, the scribes of nation Israel, the Sanhedrin, they worked hard. You know, they want their salvation the old-fashioned way. They want to earn it. So what's their response? And that's verse 12 again. The response is, and they were seeking to seize him, and yet they feared the people. For they understood that he spoke the parable against them. And so they left him and went away. So the representatives of the Sanhedrin, you know, they were experts on the Old Testament, especially the scribes who were responsible for interpreting the Old Testament. They would take this parable. Verse 1, in fact, he planted a vineyard and put a wall around it and dug a vat under the winepress and built a tower. That would take them immediately back to Isaiah chapter 5. And flip back to Isaiah chapter 5. These guys knew exactly what he was talking about. Because we have the same story in Isaiah chapter 5, starting at verse 1. It says, "Let me sing now for my well-beloved a song of my beloved concerning his vineyard. My well-beloved had a vineyard on a fertile hill and planted it with the choicest vine. And he built a tower in the middle of it and also hewed out a wine vat in it. Then he expected it to produce good grapes, but it produced only worthless ones." Now see, in this story, Israel is the vineyard. They're not the vine growers. In Israel, they produce no good fruit, is the idea. So verse 3 goes on to say, "And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more was there to do for my vineyard that I have not done for it?" And God is saying, look, I did everything I possibly could for you guys. You know, I sent slave after slave. You mistreated them. You beat them. You killed them. And why, when I expected it to produce good grapes, did it produce worthless ones? So now, let me tell you what I'm going to do to my vineyard. I will remove its hedge, and it will be consumed, and I will break down its wall, and it will become trampled ground. Now, again, this is talking about Israel and not the exact same thing, but those guys, their mind would go right back to Isaiah 5 when he started this parable about the vineyard. So the parable is a reflection on Israel and their rebellion, their unfaithfulness in response to grace. Nothing but grace. He sent a slave, he sent another, he sent another, he sent another. God gave every possible opportunity to nation Israel, and their leaders dropped the ball. They didn't take advantage of it. So it's a condemnation of their failure, the ones he's talking to. And who's he talking to? The representatives of the Sanhedrin. It's a condemnation on their failure as leaders of nation Israel. And they understood that very well. Verse 12 says that they understood that he spoke the parable against them. No question in their minds. So Jesus, as I mentioned before, he continues now his revelation of the secret of his own person. Remember, he started with a triumphal entry. Before that, he kept things pretty much under wraps. Even at the Transfiguration, remember what he told his disciples, don't tell anybody about this until after the resurrection, because they didn't understand what was happening anyway, and they didn't until after the resurrection. They still, even when he went to the cross, they didn't understand what was happening. So he told them to keep it under wraps, keep it quiet. Now, when he comes to Jerusalem, he is starting to unveil himself, so to speak. And he unveils himself here to the leaders of the Sanhedrin. What's their response? They were so blinded by their own rage that they didn't see. They didn't understand. They were blinded to the truth by their own rage and their own pride. You know, it was only the crowds, and we see that in verse 12, it says, and they were seeking to seize him, and yet they feared the people. So if it hadn't been for the crowds, they would have taken him right then and there. But they couldn't, because they were afraid of the people. Now, do you see why Jesus left the city at night? Because at night they would have had time to take him when the crowds weren't there. They will continue, that is, the leaders of nation Israel will continue to try and trap him in his answers, and we'll have that next time. The Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the scribes are going to trick him by the question about paying taxes and the question about remarriage. So they're still going to try, and of course they will fail, but we'll pick up then at verse 13 next week and look at those two tricks. Father, thank you for your word. Thank you for this parable of the vine growers, and we pray that we can understand it correctly and that we can be good stewards for you, that we can make the right decisions based on truth. In Christ's name, amen.